Welcome back to the program. A decade after her death, Pauline Kael remains the most important figure in film criticism today. She once referred to the critic as the only independent source of information. Everything else, she said, is advertising. During her tenure as a film critic for The New Yorker, she was a tastemaker, a career maker, and a career breaker. She eschewed the idea of anything being written about her, and she was very close to the vest about her personal life. But now, finally, we have a full biography of Pauline Kael, written by our guest, Brian Kello. It is my pleasure to welcome Brian Kello to the program to talk about Pauline Kael, A Life in the Dark. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. One of the things that I must say I didn't know at all about Pauline Kael is the fact that she grew up in large measure right here in the North Bay in Petaluma.
Yeah, she did. Absolutely. She was born there, and she grew up there. Her parents had come from New York. Initially, they were from Poland. They had immigrated to New York and wound up on Hester Street in pretty tough circumstances. Her father sold caps, apparently, in the street for a while. And then they found out about this community of Jewish chicken ranchers out in Petaluma, where apparently you could make a very good living if you figured out how to do it. And, of course, they had no experience at all, but they took a flyer and went out and started a chicken ranch and did quite well with it for quite some time.
Somehow it's so hard to get one's head around the idea of moving from Hester Street to a chicken farm in Petaluma.
I know. But, you know, the funny thing about that is when I began reading her when I was a kid, I got the sense right away that this was a very democratic person. This was not a member of the New York East Coast literary elite. I mean, that came through very strongly in her writing.
Well, I mean, she and Susan Sontag have had their battles over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. And Pauline really was, all of that was so alien to her temperament and her background. I mean, she came out of the Bay Area. She was very proud to have been a Westerner, as I must say I am. And I think that she came to New York for the first time in the 40s and tried to have some success as a writer. At that point, she was primarily interested in being a playwright, a story writer, this kind of thing. Later, she tried some movie treatments, and nothing just ever worked. From what I've seen of the surviving examples, they just weren't very good. And I think she knew it deep down. And thank God, you know, eventually in the early 1950s, she found her voice as a movie critic.
Talk about the degree to which that Western influence really impacted her in the way she saw the world, and beyond this sort of anti-elitist attitude, but really the way she saw the world and the kinds of things that she liked and responded to.
Right. Well, she absolutely, I mean, she grew up, as I said, a farm girl, and in a large family. She was one of five children, and I think there was just, she didn't grow up with this idea that you have to take a certain prescribed path to achieve literary success. She read like a fiend from the time she was a child. She grew up in a family of people who liked books and took her to the movies all the time and took her to concerts and plays in San Francisco. And, of course, at that time there was so much touring activity of a very high quality. Carol Channing, who grew up in the Bay Area, talked to me about that at length. In fact, this is a wonderful trivia fact in my book. Carol Channing and Pauline Kael debated each other in high school.
Wow.
Yeah, right. I wish we had a tape of that.
Right.
But I think that she just came out of it with this sense that so much of what the East Coast literary establishment had told us was the correct way was, in fact, just a lot of bull.
Right.
And I think that was a huge part of how she approached her work.
She didn't write her first film review for The New Yorker until she was 48 years old.
That's right. She what happened was, in the mid-60s, she placed one freelance article, a piece called Movies on Television, not one of her better pieces, with The New Yorker. And then there was a break, and she had unsuccessful marriages at both McCall's and the New Republic, neither of which had worked out. I mean, they really weren't the correct publications for her. And then she wrote a piece on Bonnie and Clyde, a very, very, very long piece, that she couldn't get placed anywhere else. She sent it to the New Yorker, and William Shawn, the magazine's editor-in-chief, loved it and published it in its entirety, as he was famous for doing. I mean, he didn't put those kind of space restrictions on writers he liked and respected. And it was very, very well received. It was perceived as being instrumental in helping to revive the fortunes of Bonnie and Clyde, which had had a kind of difficult release in the summer of 1967, and then the movie became a big hit, not solely because of her by any means, but she helped, certainly. And Sean thought about it and felt that there was a lot that was changing on the screen, and movie audiences were changing dramatically, content was changing, and he thought she was the person to cover it for The New Yorker because she seemed the most tuned into it. So she shared, initially, the New Yorker movie reviewing spot 6 months out of the year with Penelope Gilliatt,
right,
who was also on for 6 months.
Who came to movie reviews in a very, who was British and came to it in a very different way and from a very different perspective than Pauline Kael.
Absolutely. Absolutely, she did. I remember when I was young and I would just be desolate when Pauline's term would be up in March. She covered them roughly from September to March. And then Penelope Gilliatt would come in, and I just didn't respond to her writing at all. It was sort of like she wanted to talk around the movie and discuss all these other things, except the film itself. And, of course, Pauline was just so wonderful at dissecting the movie and telling you why what was going on in the world at the time had contributed to making the movie the way it was and contributed to audiences receiving it the way they did. I mean, she was a great sociologist, as many people have pointed out,
right,
in addition to being a great movie critic.
And that was part of the appeal of her voice, that it was so accessible. I mean, that was a huge difference, as you say, between her and Penelope Gilliatt, for example,
yeah,
is that Kael's writing was so accessible, and it was partly because it wasn't just about the movie. She was really a social critic at the time.
Yes, absolutely. And she was lusting to get her hands on the column year-round, almost from the very beginning. I mean, it used to just enrage her. Penelope Gilliatt, part of the time, created this. Do you remember that character, the little old lady,
mm-hmm,
that she created, through whose eyes we sort of saw the movie? And Pauline just thought that should not be allowed. She was incensed by it. And I interviewed a number of her New Yorker colleagues, and one of them, Jane Kramer, who writes the Letter from Europe column and has for so many years, told me that she thought Penelope Gilliatt would have been quite happy to be friends with Pauline, but it didn't really work in reverse. Although she respected her work on Sunday Bloody Sunday very much. Penelope Gilliatt wrote the screenplay,
right,
for Sunday Bloody Sunday.
One of the other things is that, and I guess William Shawn must have understood this at the time, is that movies were changing and also journalism was changing.
Yep.
And that her voice was consistent with the kind of new journalism that existed,
right,
at the time.
Very much so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she didn't like a lot of the other exponents of new journalism. She certainly didn't lump herself with all those people. Pauline never lumped herself with any group ever.
Except the Paulettes.
Yeah, well, that's true. But that was a group she created. But she, she didn't see herself as a classic New Yorker. She didn't see herself. She didn't particularly identify with other Jews, although she was born Jewish. The family was very secular, and I just don't think her ethnicity meant much of anything to her.
But she also had that. I don't know if it was Woody Allen or Groucho Marx that this originally is attributed to, but a little bit of that. I don't want to belong to any group that would have me as a member.
I suppose there was some of that. I think more to the point, she just was very skeptical of any kind of dogma whatsoever, and she felt that if you were going to belong to any religious affiliation, you know, you were going to be susceptible to that. And she was a very, very independent soul from day one, I mean, from childhood,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Talk a little bit about what was going on in the world of movies at the time, because there was this kind of flowering, this kind of renaissance of independent movies, of independent directors, people like Altman and Scorsese and,
mm-hmm,
Coppola and De Palma. Talk a little about that.
Well, it was a thrilling time. I have to admit, I'm personally very nostalgic for it. When I open the newspaper ads today and can't find one thing that I'm that interested in going to see. It was a great time that started in the late 1960s. I mean, Bonnie and Clyde was certainly one of the early signs of life on the screen. But basically, the studio system had broken down completely, and a lot of independent voices were coming through that were able to get at the feeling of unrest that was going on in the U.S. at the time, and elsewhere, too, in other countries. But it was not only the Vietnam War and the protest and civil rights, but many, many other things, women's liberation, the beginning to question the traditional family values. I mean, I grew up, I was born in 1959, so this was a period in which I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
The 70s, I was in high school and college, and it really was a thrilling time. I have very vivid memories of it. In fact, I'm working on a novel about it right now.
Mm-hmm.
But she was able to connect with all that, and these wonderful movie makers like Scorsese, who showed in The Godfather and The Godfather 2 that you could use violence in such a wonderfully expressive way. It didn't have to be something sensationalistic. Robert Altman, who showed that you didn't have to approach storytelling on film in the conventional way that had been done for the most part, that you could introduce characters and ideas in this almost elliptical way and still hold the audience riveted. And, of course, she loved that. I mean, she really felt that he'd almost reinvented the wheel. And you can feel her excitement in the reviews of those early Altman films, such as M.A.S.H. and Thieves Like Us and The
Nashville.
Long Goodbye. And, of course, the famous review, Nashville, in which she jumped the gun a bit by reviewing the movie before it was quite finished, because she wanted to call attention to great work being done.
It was also a time, and this relates to it very much, when reviews, hers most of all, but reviews in general, mattered. When filmmakers and the public cared very much. I mean, people used to wait, couldn't wait till Wednesdays when the New Yorker came out at the time to get to see what Pauline Kael was writing about.
Absolutely. They were right at the center of the culture in the 1970s. We went to see everything when we were in college. It's really amazing. As I said, I have wonderful memories of that time. You didn't want to miss anything, even the things that weren't so good. And she also, but it's not that she was just an across the board sucker for everything that was being done by any means. She also had a very, very funny, almost conservative streak when it came to the portrayal of the youth movement on screen. She felt that pictures like Five Easy Pieces and Joe, both of which were enormous hits in 1970, were promoting the idea of despair to the youth audience, that there was no point in anything, there was no point in striving for everything, everything in America was corrupt, and that was the way it was. And, of course, that was in the air to a great degree. But she didn't think that the movies should express that in a way that was going to turn anybody off from ever wanting to accomplish anything. She was very achievement-oriented, and then her nephew told me that when he was protesting the president of Berkeley University, she really wasn't very happy with him. She said, he's a very nice man. I don't think you should be doing this. she was complex where that kind of thing was concerned.
Right, because on the other hand, movies that were too ridiculously aspirational, whether it was Star Wars or It's a Wonderful Life, I mean, she hated those movies.
Right, exactly. She did. And I think that she didn't quite... I don't think she quite saw where the whole blockbuster phenomenon created that was really launched, I think, by Jaws. I suppose you could argue that it really started with The Exorcist in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But Jaws, I think, was the real summer blockbuster thing. And, of course, then with Star Wars, that just became what everyone aspired to do, was have this monster movie that just cleaned up on the opening weekend. But I think she didn't quite see the far-reaching effects of these movies. Now, Jaws she liked very much, mm-hmm. in fact. But Star Wars she did not. She really did not. She did like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. She thought it was a very imaginative movie, which it is. But she wasn't quite as quick on the draw as she normally was to predict how this was going to influence the industry and audiences, I think. And then when she saw that it really had, and that a lot of these highly individual voices that she had loved earlier, such as Paul Mazursky and Irvin Kershner, were kind of getting trampled in this big, big, big movie craze. She was very sad right. about it, very sad about it. And I think that's one of the reasons she went out to Hollywood in 1979 to work very briefly as a producer and a creative consultant, because she wanted to make a difference.
Which was not really a great experience.
That was a terrible experience. Right. Yeah, it was a disaster, really. I think she came back very wounded by it. She, once again, I mean, she was a tight-lipped lady. She did not complain much. I mean, just as she didn't talk about her past, and in fact, she tried to confuse people about her past. She was married once, and she liked to tell people she was married three times.
What was that all about?
I think it was a subterfuge. I think she just didn't want anybody poking around, and she was trying to confuse them. Her daughter, Gina, whose cooperation, unfortunately, I did not get for the book, told me on the telephone one day she loved a good story. And she told it many, many ways, often.
Did she realize when she went out to Hollywood that she was set up for failure by people like Don Simpson and a couple of others?
Well, she realized it afterwards.
Afterwards, yeah.
But she, there was a very, I was talking about this with another interviewer recently. There was a very unexpected streak of naivete in Pauline. Which I didn't know until I started working on this book, and lots of the people who were friends of hers that I interviewed corroborated it. She really did kind of believe in virtue rewarded. And she thought that if you you worked hard and did the right thing, you could really make a difference. Well, she really didn't have any experience at all with Hollywood types, other than just knowing them socially a little bit. She didn't really know how the process worked out there until she got in the middle of it, and then she found out how really horrifying it was, and that she was completely swimming in the deep end of the shark tank.
Right, and they were a lot of sharks at the time she was out there.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, Don Simpson was right. delighted to be given the opportunity to kneecap her. I mean, he told James Toback that, who told it to me. He took great pleasure. He didn't want her there in the first place. And Pauline was not a terribly political person. I think Pauline went into production meetings and said things like, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, and what a ridiculous idea, and we can't do that. This is going to be a terrible film. And, you know, if you know anything about Hollywood, you know that the people who survive still to this day are the ones who sit there and don't say anything. I mean, you know, it's the most political place in the world.
You mentioned James Toback, who was one of the Paulettes, with whom she had a personal relationship. To what extent did she have personal relationships with so many of the filmmakers of the time, people like Altman and Scorsese, etc.?
Well, Jim wasn't really, first of all, he wasn't really a Paulette. He was a movie maker. The Paulettes were really the writers that she gathered around her and took to screenings and everything. And Jim was really just a filmmaker whose work she happened to like a great deal. But I think it was the kind of kinky, unexpected quality in a lot of Jim's movies that appealed to her, such as Fingers, which I just saw again at the New York Film Festival, and I think it's held up quite well. But she liked early Scorsese very much. She loved Mean Streets. She was fascinated by much of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, although she had certain problems with it. And she loved Taxi Driver because she just thought it was this wonderful, nightmarish vision of New York in the 1970s. She didn't like later Scorsese so much. In fact, I chide her a little bit in the book, I think, because I think she gave very short shrift to King of Comedy, which is, I think, a marvelous movie.
It's interesting about that, because in many ways, I mean, you talk in the book, she loved comics, she loves comedy. It's a movie that she should have embraced, it seems.
Yeah, and I think that I think that movie, to pick dust off the old cliche, really was ahead of its time. I think this kind of guy, like Rupert Pupkin, the character Robert mm-hmm. De Niro plays, really has just come to the surface more and more, this kind of celebrity hound who will do anything for his 15 minutes of fame. I think it was really prescient in that regard, and of course Jerry Lewis is wonderful in it as the Johnny Carson character, and or whoever he's supposed to be. And I don't know. I think she thought Scorsese was taking a wrong turn, and she just couldn't quite get off that, you know.
One of the other interesting things that you write about her, and it sort of relates to some of these things that we're talking about in terms of how things hold up and how mm-hmm. they look now, is that she didn't like the idea of ever changing her mind about anything.
No, she didn't. And I heard her talk about that once. I was at a party, and this sort of stuffy academic type came up to her and asked her, it was really true that she never changed her mind about a movie, and she said, "Well, yeah, yes, it is true." And this professor said, "Well, I had to see Bergman's Persona three times before I ever felt that I had any clue what it was really about." And Pauline said very evenly and not nastily at all, "Well, that's the difference between the two of us, isn't it?" I just, you know, I was a kid at the time, and I just wanted to crawl under something out of, you know, embarrassment for this guy.
I want to talk a little bit about her, I was going to say her philosophy, but really her lack of any kind of overarching theory by which she watched films. I mean, she was very different than people like Andy Saris, for example,
right,
at the time.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit, Brian.
Well, no, she really had very little use for theory at all. She read it, she understood it. But she didn't think, again, to her that was dogma. That was dogma that kept you from exploring your own personal reaction to a piece of work, and that was paramount for her. She placed that at the highest level. I mean, nobody had a more visceral personal reaction to movies than Pauline. And I can remember when I first began reading her getting such a sense of that, because she'd practically be trembling, I think, as she wrote these reviews into the wee hours of the night, because she wanted to get down her immediate impressions before they got clouded and dissipated. And I think that comes through so brilliantly. It was a real gift she gave to her readers. You know,
she did believe that, you know, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is the title of one of her collections, she said that that's kind of what most movies were about.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And she's got a point. She really does. But I think that she also, unlike a lot of the more serious theorists who are trying so hard to explain to you why this movie is maybe good for you, like eating your spinach or something, Pauline was so wonderful, as in a different way I think Judy Crist was, at getting into the fun of the movie-going experience. I mean, she really did regard it as the great populist art form, which I think it is, and she certainly thought that there were certain things that shouldn't be taken too seriously.
Did she want her reviews to be taken seriously by filmmakers?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, there's that wonderful quote where someone asks her, I'm not quoting it exactly, I'm paraphrasing, but someone said, do you think that your body of work should be, you know, held in posterity, basically, I think was what the question was, as a guide by the people who make the movies? And she said, well, it's an impossible question to answer, because if I answer yes, I sound pompous. And if I answer no, then my life's work has been worth nothing. So I think she wanted them to do what she thought they should do. I mean, there's a terrific story in my book, which you may have read, about having dinner with Sidney Lumet mm-hmm. and having a little bit to drink and telling him, my job is to show people like him the way to go. That's what she thought it was. She thought they needed that kind of guidance, and that's what she was trying to do when she went to Hollywood. She wanted to be. She thought that the great failing in Hollywood at that time is that there were no more great producers like the Daryl Zanucks and people like that who could really sit on these directors and help them realize their vision, but also help them from giving in to their excesses. And that's what she wanted to do.
Talk about her feud, well, more than a feud. I mean, she, as tough as she was really stung by this article in the New York Review of Books that Renata Adler wrote about her in 1980.
Yeah, she was very wounded by it.
Talk about that.
Well, it was. I remember reading it, and I was just horrified by it. It was a piece by Renata Adler, who also had a long history with The New Yorker, and was an occasional film critic at various publications, including The New Yorker. And Adler wrote it. It was supposed to be a review, basically, of Pauline's collections when the lights go down, which was published in 1980. And Adler basically dismantled her as a writer. She had said that she'd always kind of admired her prior to sitting down to read this collection, and when she went through it, she found that the entire collection was word for word worthless. I mean, that she used the word worthless, and then she proceeded to decimate her style, which of course was one of the great things about Pauline. She just tore her style apart completely. She ridiculed her for her use of scatological references, her hyperbole, her bending of critical language. She called her a bully. She found a lot of her criticism took on a bullying nature. She was absolutely screaming at the reader to agree with her about what she thought. Well, I mean, she wasn't the passive critic in any sense of the word, but it was a damning piece, and of course, I don't think any literary squabble of that year got as much attention in the press. It was covered everywhere, and she was very wounded by it. She just didn't really know how to respond to it.
There was also a lot of reference that Adler made to Kale's sexual conduct references in her reviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So she was not in favor of that at all. I wrote to her, hoping to get her to speak to me for my book, but she didn't answer, and I think she just felt she'd said everything she had to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Talk a little bit about Kale's attraction to and fantastic review of Last Tango, because that certainly is one of her preeminent reviews.
Yes, absolutely. She saw it at the New York Film Festival in the fall of 1972, and she flipped over it. She thought it was finally the honest truth about what can really happen sexually between a man and a woman. And while everybody was, you know, running around screaming that it was pornography and this and that, and you know, it wasn't a great masterpiece, as many of the critics were trying to say it was, Pauline likened it to, as a cultural event, to the world premiere of The Rite of Spring. And what she meant by that, I think, was that it had shaken up people's sensibility in a similar way. And that's what she always wanted to happen. I mean, she didn't see the point in just audiences going year in and year out and decade out to the same kind of movies where there was no growth possible. I mean, she was not a great fan of many of the factory-produced, you know, quote-unquote movie classics of the 1940s and 50s at all.
Mm-hmm.
She was very tough on a lot of them. I mean, she hated Mrs. Miniver with a passion. She just, I think she wanted them all to be killed, not just Teresa Wright. But she, in Last Tango, she really felt that this kind of raw nerve of truth had been struck in the way these people just go at each other in this apartment and kind of block out the rest of the world. And Brando says at one point in the script, everything outside this place is nothing. You know, everything that matters is right here. And I think that's what Pauline thought true intimacy was, between two people, and I think, I know, she also thought that it was basically impossible to achieve.
Is it your sense that there is, and obviously the attention to your book is part of this, a reemergence, some kind of a resurgence of interest in the 70s, in this period?
Oh, I think definitely. I mean, this memoir, I haven't had a chance to read it yet because I've been so busy with my own book launch, but this memoir by James Wolcott,
right,
who was a friend and protege of Pauline's, called Lucking Out, is about coming to New York in the 70s,
right,
and the wild times back then. No, I think so. I mean, I certainly didn't expect, and I don't think anybody at Viking, my publisher, expected either, that our book was going to have this kind of amazing reception. But I do think that must have something to do with it, because I think people are starved for this kind of personality on the page, this kind of critic as personality. I mean, one of her friends, Ray Sawhill, described what she did as performance art, and I think that's not a bad way to describe it.
Brian Kello, the book is Pauline Kael, A Life in the Dark. Brian, I thank you so much for
Absolutely.
Spending time with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Appreciate it.